My name is William Rankin Maltman. I was born in Minnetonka, Manitoba on November the 24th, 1922. I am of Scottish background. My formal education is grade 8.
Did you go to Minnetonka?
Yes, I did. All my education was in Minnetonka prior to the war. I joined the Winnipeg Grenadiers in 1940 at the age of 17 and went to Jamaica in June of the same year.
Hmm. Can I ask why you joined the Grenadiers?
Why I joined the Grenadiers?
Well, that. Did your friends go in?
Well, the reason why I joined the army at the age I was, let me put it that way, was because I'm I believe in freedom. I felt that our freedom was, of course, being threatened. I'm very loyal to, might say, king and country at that time. And when I decided that I would join the army, I came into Winnipeg about the middle of March of 1940 and stayed with my aunt on Wellington Crescent. And my uncle had been an officer in the 78th Battalion during the 1914-18 war. But on going out to Fort Osborne Barracks, I tried to get into the PPCLI. But a sergeant major told me that I should go home for a couple of years and come back. So anyway, when I heard, when I was told that, I talked to my aunt and she says, well, why don't you join the Winnipeg Grenadiers? Of course, I didn't really know who the Winnipeg Grenadiers were until she had told me about Uncle Don Ross being in the 78th Battalion.
Was the war broken
out? Oh, yes, that was 1940.
Do you have any trouble getting in the Grenadiers?
Well, the only way I got into the Grenadiers was through, I believe his rank was a Sergeant Thompson in the Winnipeg Grenadier Band that knew my uncle, Jim Maltman of Minnetonka. And on his say-so, they allowed me in the Grenadiers without disputing my age.
17.
Yes. So on April the 4th, 1940, I was sworn in as a full-fledged member of the Winnipeg Grenadiers MG.
Did you worry about me at the time when you were only 17?
Not at all. No, I didn't. For the first 2 or 3 weeks, they didn't have any uniforms for us, and then of course, I was given the old 1914-18 uniform, and Major Morley, the quartermaster, gave me a coat that I believe that 3 or 4 of us could have got into. Anyway, it fitted, according to him. Very little. We qualified on the Vickers machine guns at St. Charles Ranges, and also qualified on our rifles before going to Jamaica. Oh, yes, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, most of the, I believe, is the other friends that have been on this tape before has probably mentioned the fact that the old Vickers machine guns that we trained on were for training purposes only, not for firing. And we also, when we qualified for our machine gun was that the ammunition was also 1914-18, and it sometime dribbled out the end of the barrel and fell on the ground. Well, it's fact. It was quite humorous to see some of the shells that we were using.
When you went down to Jamaica?
Yes, we left Winnipeg, I believe it was, on June 7th, 1940. And we were in Halifax, tied up at one of the wharfs there for a week, and we used to go on our daily route march around there's a point of land anyway there. It was an old fort or something that overlooked the Halifax Harbor. I don't know what the name of it was. And there were several of the boys. A fellow by the name of Bill Blue, that as soon as he stepped foot on the boat, even though it was tied up at the docks, got sick. He couldn't get out of bed. And that, of course, lasted until we arrived in Jamaica. We had first stopped in Hamilton, Bermuda, and took a little route march around the island there to sort of stretch our legs after being on board ship for a while, and then proceeded to Kingston, Jamaica, where we we had a lot of fun for 17 months, although there was a lot of hard work too.
Something I'm kind of interested in, the Grenadiers were machine gun regiments.
Yes.
They left Winnipeg, but when they came back, you were made in the infantry component.
Yes, well, that was in sometime the end of April or the 1st of May, the Canadian Army was asked to supply a regiment for garrison duty in British West Indies. And they held drumhead services. I don't know whether Winnipeg was only one of them or was the one, but all regiments were paraded on the legislative building on May the 12th. And we were marched past on a reviewing stand, and the Winnipeg Grenadiers were chosen to go to Jamaica because of its training at that time. And there has been talk that they had sufficient machine gun regiments available without the Grenadiers being left in that category. And we were taken out of, I believe, the 1st or 2nd Division and put in about the 4th Division or something along these lines.
How did you feel about it?
About going to Jamaica?
No, about becoming infantry rather than machine gun.
Well, we must remember, I believe, that in those early days of the war, even if you were a machine gun regiment, you were still pounding the ground, you know. There weren't that many, there wasn't that much transport at that time. No, I think that I had no remorse really in us being changed to an infantry battalion. We probably would have liked to maintain the MG behind the name, but I don't really have any reason to say that it wasn't a good thing or a bad thing.
When you came back to Winnipeg, I thought you didn't know where you were going when you came back to...
No. We came back, arrived here on the 25th of September, 1941. And we were billeted at the old Robinson building. I believe that's Arthur Street, isn't it? And of course, were given a disembarkation leave to go home. I went home for a few days, and I come back into Winnipeg and be with the boys, and then we were told that we were going to be posted overseas. We didn't know where. We knew we were going west to somewhere in the Far East. We weren't told. So we were then, of course, given our embarkation leave, 48 hours or 72 hours, whatever it is. And I went up home and I seen my mom and dad and family and came back, and we left Winnipeg, I believe it was October the 25th. Oh, I didn't know. I guess I'll go again if I was called up. But when we got into Vancouver, the RMS Awatea had been set up as a troop ship, which was an Australian mail ship and passenger ship. It was a beautiful ship. But one thing that bothered us was the mutton that we got. And there was a little bit of a confrontation with the powers that be on board ship that if the Air Force could walk off the ship, so could the Army, if they were going to feed us mutton.
I understand the quarters.
Well, I didn't worry too much about the quarters. I was worried about food. And there were several of the Winnipeg Grenadiers that created a little mutiny on board, and about 35 or 40 walked off the ship.
It wasn't really effective, though.
It could have been, but something went awry anyway.
You know why it didn't work?
I never really found that out. I guess I'd have to say I was a bit of part of that mutiny, but we were never caught up with most of us. We did go back on board ship. There were several that didn't. But they got that ship out of that harbor in a hurry and lay off of a Vancouver Island somewhere, so we couldn't cause any more trouble. No, I never get seasick. Mm-hmm. No. There's no way that for me to get seasick. I love sailing. I had to get on a boat and sail forever. I'm sort of my ancestors in Scotland were all deep sea fisher people. And
you like the ocean and the sea?
Oh yeah. There was no doubt that this was one of the highlights of my life, was to get on board a ship and just sail. I didn't care how rough it got or how smooth it got.
Mm-hmm. Remember much about the sailing? It was pretty.
On board ship, once we got going, they took away the mutton. They fed us Australian rabbit instead. Well, it wasn't too bad, really. It was edible, and it was a little bit better than the mutton, I'll tell you. But we did. We were taught some form of hand-to-hand combat and also some of the workings of the Thompson submachine gun.
Have you taken any of that kind of training before?
No. Now, the hand-to-hand combat was in the use of using your steel helmet as a weapon in the event that you lost your rifle or something.
Steel helmet?
Yes. Just on your hand, like a knife or... You know, you grabbed the hold of the chin strap on around your wrist and used it as a knife, you might say, which was quite effective. And also they taught us some very basic knowledge of judo, I suppose, or jiu-jitsu. And this, of course, helped. I didn't get involved with anything like that. Maybe some of the boys did. But I had no hand-to-hand combat myself.
This would be very different from any kind of
Yes. It was, see, you must remember that Hong Kong is a, was a guerrilla type of warfare, where you took a, say, a platoon or company of men and you hit as hard and as fast as you could and get the hell out,
right.
You know. Sometimes you just didn't get out fast enough. But
you really hadn't had too much training in long.
No. See, when we arrived in Hong Kong on November the 16th, I was 18. I was. We were there for 4 or 5 days. Then we were put up into the hills of Pak Fulham on the island of Hong Kong, and that in the dairy farm, and we had to fix up trenches. And I think I went in on November the 23rd, and my 19th birthday was the 24th, so we celebrated it.
It must have been quite an experience getting off the boat in Hong Kong.
Well, we were met with the Royal Scots, or by the Royal Scots. 2nd Regiment, 7th Battalion of the Royal Scots. And their pipes and drums played us from the Kowloon Dock by the Peninsula Hotel down to Sham Shui Po Barracks. And I suppose it was quite an impressive show of strength of the highly trained Canadians that were there.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember, were there any reactions from the Chinese people?
Not really. I never remember of any.
Remember if they were yelling hello or go home?
No, I can't say I remember anything like that. I think by the time we had marched about 2 or 3, maybe 4 miles up Nathan Road to Sham Shui Po Barracks, and when we got into the barracks, I remember there was a number of us that tired of waiting to get our mattresses and sheets and so on from the quartermaster. So we went over to the NAFI canteen and we proceeded to drink. No, this was in the Sham Shui Po Barracks. And I remember, after we'd been sitting there a number of hours, I guess, drinking Chinese beer, my sergeant major, Sergeant Major Fryett, came in, and I was a bit of a favorite with him for some reason, I guess because of my age. He'd say, "Maltman," he said to me, "Maltman, what are you doing? Why don't you go get your blankets?" And I suggested he sit down and have a beer with us. So he did. And he left with the understanding that we were going to be right behind him, but I don't remember whether we got out of there right on time or not.
Mm-hmm. Were you expecting more suggestions? They weren't very far away.
Yes, they were. The time when we really found out where we were actually off to was when we landed in, or when we were in Manila, in the Philippines overnight. And the next morning we had, of course, a British destroyer with us along with the Prince Robert. And we were informed that we were going to Hong Kong and that we may even have to fight our way off the boat. I remember being told that we could possibly fight our way off the boat. I don't know how that well that would have gone, but anyway.
Would that make you feel different?
You know, but it's funny when you're young like that and there's a war is raging all over the world, and you're thinking of the people at home and so on. I wasn't, don't get me wrong, I wasn't any hero, but I wasn't a coward either. Because anybody that says that they weren't scared, is that's for the birds.
Did you do any training in the weeks previously?
No, not really. We were supposed to go up on the border between the new territories and China. The new territories are the British held territory of the Hong Kong area. But we never did get there. We went into our company was dispatched back into the hill for certain maneuvers, company maneuvers, really. B Company.
Mm-hmm.
And we were stationed in the dairy farm in Pak Fulham for until actually December the 7th. That's Hong Kong time. That's December the 6th here. And we were going to come out of the trenches this maneuver on the 7th of December, and we got out part way and we were told that we better go back in because something might happen. So we were we were sitting the next morning, I guess we were up there quite early.
Were you sleeping in the trenches?
Well, we had pup tents. And we were, our platoon commander had a, and the sergeants, or the sergeant, platoon sergeant, Sergeant Foster. I was just trying to remember the name of the officer. Funny, it slipped my mind. But anyway, we were sitting out inside this bivouac, concrete shack, you know. And he says, "Oh, geez, there's some planes coming." Knew we didn't have any. And we had no radios either. And this was on the morning of the 8th over there. All hell started breaking loose. Anti-aircraft and so on and so forth. And so the platoon commander came out and said, "Well," he says, "the Japanese have declared war on the Allies and so on and so forth." So in the days right after that, we had to put up barbed wire around our position and so on and so forth, and then we dug an air raid shelter. This was sort of a funny thing. There was, we had dug this small air raid shelter for the ones that couldn't get into the bivouac, and we didn't have a roof on it at the time, and there was several Japanese come over on an air raid, and there was several of us crouching in this fancy air raid shelter of ours, and a fellow by the name of Doug Hawks, he is also dead, but he was in front of me, and the Japs were trying to hit something around there fairly close. But anyway, there was a piece of mud that came and hit him in the hand, and he talked rather slow, and I still remember it like yesterday, you know. He said, "Who the hell hit me?" I saw the mud hit him, you know. it was rather funny, but too bad the guy didn't live. Enjoy the little joke. And then on, well, we just guarded this position and hoped that...
Did you know how it would turn out? Did you have any expectations? Do you think the Japanese would get as far as the Japanese? Did you know?
Well, we were not. We didn't really know. We couldn't tell. The news that filtered through to us was rather meager. we were told around the 12th that the Japanese, well, we knew the Japanese had taken the mainland because we had a D company of the Grenadiers go over to the island just shortly after to fight the rear guard action for the British troops off the border where the Japanese come through. This wasn't the intention. This wasn't supposed to have happened. All the guns that were on the island were facing the sea, and they figured that the Japanese would never come overland, which were best laid plans, eh? So anyway, they took the island. I mean, they took Kowloon Peninsula, and then we all got over. Well, all the troops got onto the island, and we.
Did you
ever
meet or see any of the troops that had been in action against the
Japanese? Yes, on the. I guess that would. There was on the 17th, I believe. I'm just trying to remember the exact dates. I might be wrong by a day or so, but we had some of the casualties that came into our area. About a day before we left our position to go and wipe up the Japs up around the Wan Chai Gap and Wang Lei Chung. So our company was moved out on the morning, I believe, of the 19th. That's after the Japs had got a pretty good foothold, and we were going to wipe them out up there. So we went from Pakfulam up through Aberdeen to Wan Chai Gap, and I guess we arrived there sometime, I don't know, about 12 o'clock noon or something like that. And then we lay around for a while in Wan Chai Gap, and around in the early evening we were brought together, and I remember again our illustrious Sergeant Major Fryatt. He came to me and he says, "Well, Maltman, this is it." And he says, "We're going in." Well, I didn't say anything. What can you say? So we went from Wan Chai Gap we proceeded, let's put it this way, under cover of darkness. We proceeded up Black Links Road to the base of Mount Nicholson. And it was raining all that night.
Difficult going?
Yes, when you're trying to climb a vertical hill, mountain or hill, whatever you like to say, with your rifle and loaded with as much rifle ammunition and hand grenades as you can take, along with 4 or 5 3-inch trench mortar shells. We got up about halfway up Mount Nicholson, and they decided that we would stay there for the night in this group of rocks on the side of Mount Nicholson. I do have those at home, a picture of those rocks at home. There was 3 of us. I had a blanket. Didn't help much, but I had a blanket that was soaking wet. But there was 3 of us, Ganton and Cam Modess and myself, used this blanket as some shield from the rain. But I believe that was the longest night that I can remember in my life. But we did get through the night, and we left just before dawn to go to the top with our scouts ahead of us. I won't mention the name of the scouts we had, but one of our scouts had a bet with one of the boys in the company that I was with, that he would be the first one to shoot a Jap. He was the first one to shoot a Jap in that particular company. The men, but he also tipped off the Japanese, which caused a great amount of problems for the other two platoons down on the Black Lynx Road going around the base of Mount Nicholson. We had one section of 3-inch trench mortars and one platoon of infantry, I suppose we'll call ourselves. We had no armor of any kind, which wouldn't have been any good up there anyway. And we got into quite a good battle with the Japanese. I don't know exactly how long it lasted. It lasted from somewhere around 6 in the morning till around 9 or 10 in the morning when we were given the order, get out. In the meantime, I had been hit. I was on the extreme left flank with the artillery firing from, that's the Japanese artillery firing from the mainland. And the last shell, it was funny, the last shell they fired came pretty close. I was hit a little bit in the leg, but it wasn't that much. I was still able to walk anyway. And I know I went with about 4 or 5 feet, maybe 6 feet in the air. I thought I had had it. It was just purely concussion. I don't know, maybe a 5-6 inch shell, maybe. But when on our way out, we had quite a time getting out because the charge of the light brigade, we had Japs on the right and Canadians on the left and somebody else in front of us. But we were able to navigate out of there. Our casualties were pretty high. And
did you go down the hill?
Yes, we came down the practically straight down. We had one wounded man with us. I mean, that was hit pretty badly. And you could see the St. Stephen's Convent from where we were down in the valley just above Happy Valley Racetrack. And on our way down, we were all privates, there was six of us, and the man that was hit quite so badly was Charlie Edgley, and I would say that that was a very poorly organized group of people, but I suppose under the circumstance it couldn't have been any other way. There was myself and Davidson that was more or less took charge of the group, and we tried to get some organization working for us, I guess, to try and rally these fellows together, and also in helping to bring out Charlie. Well, in that particular battle between the boys that were caught on the road at the base of Mount Nicholson and ourselves, we had over 60% casualties in the 4 hours. We had out of about 100 and maybe 110 men, there was about 25 or 30 killed in that outright, and then we had quite a number of boys over and above that were wounded.
Was it the Japanese had so many more men, or was it?
Oh yes, well,
the whole
what we can what we can find out was that our action on the top of the hill, there was no way that those Japanese were going to come up over the peak of the Mount Nicholson because it was too small, and we could have concentrated our firepower where they would never. They would have lost probably their whole battalion, which they should have done had this scout not have fired on them, because we could have all got into position properly before, because these Japanese were sleeping. But when this here fellow shot this Jap, as I say, that tipped them off, and we chased them from the top of Mount Nicholson down. And of course, our other two platoons on the road below had nowhere to go, and the Japs just plastered them right on the road. It was quite a slaughter. And anyway, when we were about halfway down this mountain, we could see that Charlie was not going to make it the way he was by dragging him, because he was a pretty heavy man. He was over 200 pounds, and we couldn't lift him because of his wounds in his groins and so on. So we drew straws between Davidson and I, who would go to try and get a stretcher, a basket stretcher. And my name came out of the hat. So I, rather than go by myself, I felt that if it would be better to take two, because one guy would probably get through, if not both of us, which of course I was quite interested in getting through. But during our descent off the edge of that mountain, which, as I say, was very steep, extremely steep, we moved fast, and when we did move, then we were able to get down to a cement storm sewer, open sewer, and we jumped into this storm sewer, and we didn't know the Royal Scots were in that vicinity at all. And we come around the bend of this ruddy sewer, and geez, we looked up and all we saw was legs. And we were again very lucky in not getting probably fired on from the Royal Scots. But anyway, we spoke up rather quickly, and we were taken to the battalion headquarters of Royal Scots, Colonel White and RSM and several others were in this particular spot, and they, of course, interrogated us to say, well, who are you, where are you from, what are you doing there, how did you get down here, etc., etc., and we explained to them what had happened and so on and so forth and what we had come down this way for. And he said, well, you're not going back up there. He says, the place is crawling with Japs. He says, you'd never get back up. I said, well, there was several of our boys up there with a badly wounded man, and that we wanted to get a basket stretcher up. Well, he says, you'll have to go back to your battalion headquarters in Wan Chai Gap, and it took us, oh, maybe half an hour or so to get back, because we went back from just below St. Stephen's Convent to Wan Chai Gap by truck. So we got back there, and that was the night of the 19th. No. Night of the... we were in Wan Chai Gap for the 20th. It was the morning of the 20th. We went in on the 19th, and the scrap was in the next morning. So I myself and this other fellow that was with me, we related the story to our superiors in Wan Chai Gap, and they we were given in the meantime. The night of the 20th. These, during the night sometime, the other fellows that were with Charlie decided that rather than bring them out, they left them there. And I said, why? And the next morning when these fellows showed up on the 21st, I said, why did you do that? It was sufficient of you there to bring them out. Well, they left a rifle with them. So we went to work and tried to get a party together to go back with a basket stretcher. And we got the okay. But when we got to the Royal Scout headquarters, again we were told, no way are you guys going up there for one man. So we were pinned down there quite good for the rest of the day. They suggested that we get back to our battalion, but we couldn't get out of the Royal Scout headquarters because the Japs pretty well kept the machine guns, so we were pretty well down there all the time. And then early in the afternoon, I'd say 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon possibly, we did get out of the Royal Scout headquarters and into a ravine where some of the Royal Scots troops were, had set up quite a little billywhack there. And we were, of course, pinned down there all day long. And they even tried to bomb us out of there, but they couldn't do it. We had one machine gun that the Royal Scots had one machine gun set up in the bottom of this ravine that overlooked Wong Le Chung Gap. And this machine gunner was sitting behind it, and he just happened to get up and walk away from it, and he may have been 15, 20 feet away from it, and all of a sudden that gun went about 20 feet in the air. The Japs had zeroed in on it pretty good. And he looked around, and I'm telling you, he just turned white. Because that was pretty close to us all. It wasn't a very big area we were in.
Did you function as a regiment?
Not really, no. On the... when we got back to Wanchai Gap on the night of the 21st, yes, I believe this was, I guess it was night of the 22nd when we were, it was either the 21st or 22nd, dates are a little fuzzy, but about 12 or 1 o'clock we were informed that we had to take the women and children out of Wanchai Gap. We took them up to the peak during the night, and then, yes, that's right, and we stayed at the peak for a day, which I believe was the 22nd, the night of the 22nd, the day in the, as I say, dates escape me right now. We stayed anyway one day at the peak where we were shelled pretty good in a house, big house up there, a mansion, I suppose. And then we were dispatched back to Wanchai Gap. And I remember... during the day, there was an old fellow we had, his name was Dick Ooman. He came in, he was an old Dutchman. He came into this room we were in and he said, who volunteered to go get some cigars? So I said, this is broad daylight. So I said, well, okay, Dick, I'll go with you. So we buggered off to a house where all the battalion kit bags and so on was stored. And it was quite a large house, about 3 or 4 stories. Again, as I say, you call it a mansion. And so we started searching for cigars. We come across a few locked cupboards, which we had to get open. And he found his cigars, and found a number of them. And then we had been scrounging around also in the base, in the kitchen part, and we thought that, well, we found some water, and we found some tea, so we thought we would build a fire. And we got the fire going, we put the kettle on. And I suppose it was just starting to nicely boil when Jesus, all hell broke loose. I guess they spotted the smoke. I don't know whether it was our guns or the Japanese artillery, whatever it was. But Jesus, that whole roof went off, that thing, about 2 or 3 stories up. So Dick looked at me, and I looked at Dick. I said, "There's no bloody place for us. We'll get the hell out of here." So we worked our way back to the Wan Chai Gap.
With the cigars?
Oh, yes, we still had the cigars. We never got our tea. This, I believe, was the 24th of December. And then when we got back, we were under Lieutenant Corrigan, Len Corrigan. He's in Swift Current right now. He's postmaster out there, I believe, which we used to call Wrong Way Corrigan. But anyway, we were then taken up further up towards the base of Mount Cameron. And we were given orders to take up positions along a road just at the base of Mount Cameron. I don't know what it was, whether there was a name to it or not. But anyway, myself and another fellow was posted as the listening post a little bit further up, but still along the road. And we had we had pretty good protection there. And the night of the December 24th, we were sat there pretty well all night, and we decided that we had a couple of blankets, and we figured that, well, no reason why you can't have something smoked, you know, on the listening post. Well, we did. And my partner had the first flash of having a cigarette. And so he said, "Okay," he says, "Well, use that one now." And so I get underneath this bloody blanket. You know, when you're blowing smoke under a blanket, it's about to suffocate you. So anyway, I had just finished having this smoke, and it was just before dawn. And there was a bush towards my back on the road. You know, the bush came up to the road, and we were sitting there. And I just rested my rifle on my lap, and I was sitting there. And I looked up, and here's three silhouettes of men standing right over me. I'll tell you, scared I am. We weren't told that anybody was going to be gone there. Or we should have been more prepared, I suppose. But anyway, we couldn't have spoken. I don't think we had wanted to, but we brought our rifles around, and I guess the fellows on the road saw the movement, and he said, "Shh, Royal Scots Dawn Patrol." He says, "Can I get in contact with Lieutenant Corrigan?" So my partner took these fellows down to Lieutenant Corrigan, and But in the meantime, we didn't know that Lieutenant Corrigan had been out on a little skirmish of his own that morning, along with several of the other boys. And they ran into a Japanese dawn patrol. And Lieutenant Corrigan caught a sword in his hand. It didn't cut it off, but it made quite a mess. And they had quite a little scrap that morning, but they come out on top. I believe they wiped out the Japanese dawn patrol. But anyway,
it was quite close fighting, you know, almost hand to hand.
Well, in that case, it was. Yes, it was Patterson that took on, I believe, three Japs out of the bayonet and got them all. And, he saved one of the other boys. I was just trying to remember his name. I can't remember. I was told his story. And anyway, while my partner was away, the Japanese decided that they should see if they could draw or fire. And we were told, no, don't even fire. No way. It was getting daylight at this time. So anyway, we were all called down to this house where the quartermaster stores was in Wan Chai. And there was, I think, 35 of us. And we were given an alternative that it was either we attacked Mount Cameron, which was lousy with Japs, I think, from the bottom to the top and over the hills, or go street fighting in Victoria, Hong Kong, in the city, I think that is. That was on Christmas Day or Christmas morning. So we were quite convinced that 35 men wasn't going to do much damage against possibly two or three battalions of Japanese that were pretty well dug in on Mount Cameron. So we decided that the only thing to do that would at least give us a chance was to go fighting in the streets of Victoria. We then loaded ourselves up with as much hand grenades and rifle ammunition as we could, and we started out, and we got to the battalion headquarters, the Grenadiers. And we were held up there for quite some time, and it was decided that we would have to draw back because the Japanese, there was Japanese everywhere, believe me. And so the battalion started their withdrawal. You know, the British Army never retreats, it withdraws. So we withdrew to I don't know the name of that place that we were in. It was a hospital anyway. This was laid on on December the 25th. It was just a matter of time, but that in the retreat or the withdrawal, there was one of our fellows that had somehow come in contact with a hand grenade. And there was myself and another fellow that helped him to get to a hospital. He was still able to walk or run, depending on the situation, because it was a pretty disastrous situation. There was just no hope at all for any great amount of sustained fighting in any one place. We were completely overpowered. And we retreated down this road, I remember, which you could see Wan Chai Gap from this road. And it seemed as I remember it, we we kept this fellow going, and the Japanese just seemed to want to, what will we say, keep us on the run to some degree. And we were, you could see the bullets hitting, but just behind us, maybe 6-8 feet behind us. So if you slow down, you're in trouble. But we got up there, and then we took this fellow into a first aid station. And he was taken care of, and we took him over to the hospital. And we got in. First of all, they wouldn't let us in the hospital with our rifles or anything, no arms. And this is, there was three or four of us in the hospital in the kitchen, as a matter of fact, having something to eat. It was about the first we'd had all day, a couple of days or something. And this was around 5:30 or something, on Christmas Day, and we were informed that the island had been surrendered. And we went back to the house when we heard this, and we got our rifles, and it was suggested that we take the bolts out of the rifles and take the bolts apart and throw them away, so that they wouldn't be any more good than they could be to the Japanese. So that night it was a pretty sorry bunch. I guess you have to go through a surrender before you really know what it's like. And I thought that we had given it our best. It wasn't the military that surrendered the island. It was the governor of the island that surrendered, not us. We couldn't have probably lasted any more than maybe 2 or 3 days, if that long. There was no communications, there was nothing. The Japanese completely severed all communications.
Did you have enough equipment or food?
No, the equipment was something, again, you see, we didn't have any armor at all, nothing. All we had was rifles, a few hand grenades. And a lot of the hand grenades, we had to check them to see whether they were charged with the detonator or fuse. And a few light machine guns, really. And of course, a lot of our NCOs and officers had been killed. And which, of course, didn't help matters any. Although a lot of privates and so on that did take over at times, really only took over because there was no one else there to take over. And there was one fellow the night of the, see, there was burning trucks and artillery going fired backwards in our magazines. What there were of them were up in flames and so on, that the Japanese couldn't get too much ammunition.
What did you think of your officers?
I didn't have anything against any of the officers that I came in contact with. Not during the battle of Hong Kong, no. A lot of the officers of our company were killed. And they fought just the same as we all tried to. Under the circumstances, it was a rather it's a hard thing to surrender, believe me.
Is there anyone that sort of stands out in your mind?
As an officer?
Yeah, or just...
Major?
Just maybe not so much an officer, just someone who's...
They're both dead now. Major Harry Hook and Captain Jack. Oh, Jack. No. He wasn't with us. Oh, he's a tailor over here. Isn't that funny? Well, his tailor shop, I believe his wife still operates a tailor shop over in Smith Street or somewhere. Somewhere over there. Or Gary. Isn't that funny? When names escape you. But anyway, there were Lieutenant Corrigan, I suppose McKillop, they're all dead. Sports announcer that was with us, Red, Lieutenant, he was killed in our company. That's another fellow, I forget the name of. But anyway, there was these are the fellows that I knew best. And there was one of our fellows that after the surrender, he killed himself. He threw himself into, when you see guys throw themselves into burning trucks, they are very dedicated soldiers, believe me. Major Hook wouldn't throw his revolver away for quite a long time. He had to think an awful lot before he gave up. He thought and he thought. Maybe that's why he isn't here today. He maybe got better of him, I don't know. And when we were that night, we marched up to Peak Mansions, and Staff Sergeant McNaughton got us into the sort of a drill hall sort of thing there, gymnasium. And he says, there's one thing these little slant-eyed bastards can't stop us from doing is singing. So he led us in song, and of course we sang Auld Lang Syne and so on and so forth. And my leg was getting a bit sorer by that time. I guess things you get think about thinking about yourself maybe more. And so anyway, we never saw the Japanese that night. The next day, I think it was the 26th, because there were still pockets of resistance in the island. I believe Stanley was the last one to give up because they had no communication. They didn't know the island had been surrendered. So anyway, the Japanese showed up that night and they ogled us for a while and didn't know really what to think of us or what to think of. We didn't know what to think of them or what they might try and do. But the next day we were marched from there down to University of Hong Kong, I believe they call it, the University of Victoria, something like that. And they put us on that campus and then they circled us with machine guns. And I'm sure if anybody ever had have tried to make a dash for freedom, or none of us would have come out of there. But they were. I went to see the doctor after marching down that to this university. A doctor looked at my leg and he put a pair of forceps in there and tried to get whatever was in there. He made it bleed pretty good. So he thought I better go up to see Bowen Road Hospital, that's a military hospital. And they put me in there. And then they transferred me to St. Stephen's College. It was a Catholic place, which had been turned over into a, made into a hospital. That was, by the way, that's the same one as the foot of Mount Nicholson, eh?
But the Japanese built a hospital.
Oh, well, they, well, yes, that's the one. They shot nurses through the window and they bayoneted a couple in that hospital. And I was there then with my leg for, from then until about the first week of February 1942. It didn't seem very much when I got hit, but it took quite a long time to heal up. I guess they didn't want me to go to the North Point camp until it was. But in the meantime, we had made a few trips across the mountain, Mount Cameron, down into Wan Chai Gap, without being caught, mind you.
And sort of like going out from the hospital?
From the hospital, yeah. And three or four of us used to go over to the old quartermaster stores and pick up battle dress, shoes and stuff like this, or anything that we'd come across. And then we also buried the dead of B Company from that hospital. We took both, on one burial party we buried, that I remember, 19. And then we went up on the top of the hill that was on Mount Nicholson, and we buried several up there. I just forget the number, but we got them all buried. We had both the Catholic and Protestant padres that, because we didn't know who was Catholic and who was Protestant, so it was sort of a joint effort.
Did you go with the Japanese?
No, we did that on our own. We did that on our own. They didn't. Well, I can't say too much what they did there, because we were. They didn't bother the hospital after it was all over. It was quite amazing. We never done that. Not least at our place we were. We were. They took a lot of food away from us, but they. I can't say that they really did us any harm in that particular time.
I understand that a Japanese officer took a couple of his men out and shot them. I think it was for looting or something.
Hmm?
Somebody told me that a Japanese officer, I don't know if it was a bomber or hospital or not, a couple of Japanese that came, this soldier that came in, so to be watchers and things like that. An officer came in and caught them and shot them.
Oh, I've heard of that. That's your own men.
Yeah.
Yes. That's right. That's at least the story I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, when after we had pretty well got over it, and they knew they were going to close it, they knew the Japanese were going to close that hospital. There was lots of food in there, but they wouldn't give it to you. Not the Japanese, but our own. The British officers and so on, doctors that were in charge, just wouldn't give out the food. So I imagine, I guess the Japanese got most of that food, I don't know. So we went to
Was it British officers who were in charge after?
Well, not necessarily. It depended on where you were on the island.
It was the officer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Most of the time, yeah. So anyway, then we. About the first week of February, we were taken to North Point Camp, where it's funny, I can't remember how long we were in that camp. It just completely escaped my mind, that whether I wanted to forget it or not, I don't know. But anyway, while we were there, I lost a lot of weight. I was in pretty good shape, of course, when I come from the hospital. But I developed a lot of boils and could do nothing with them. On the back of my hand here, as a matter of fact, there's a scar here where the last one, you can hardly see it now, but this, when this boil came up, I'm telling you, that hand swole about three times the size, and I was given a prescription to get boiling water or hot water from the kitchen to make sure that all the poison came out. And after that particular boil on the back of my hand, that there was no more boils. But after that, I got dysentery. And a lot of the boys got dysentery then. And I lost 45 pounds in a week. Oh, that's a lot of weight. Because when you go to the bathroom, the hospital in North Point Camp was just an old building. No beds or stretchers that we were on, and a common toilet that you know, like usually bread and shit all over the place. And when we got out of that, I don't remember, I was, I guess, 115, 120 pounds. And then we had the where the four Canadian boys, Sergeant Payne and Kelly and a couple other boys, escaped from camp, and the Japanese got us up. And we were there all night long on the parade square. They would not allow us off the parade square.
The night
yes, the night. I guess it was the night they escaped, to the next night, whenever they found they were missing. I believe it was the night they got out. I never bought it and remember those days. But we were kept up there all night long, and they did. When they found them, they apparently made them dig their own grave and then shot them. And then we were moved to Shamshiko, where there was a lot of atrocities in that camp.
Shamshiko?
Yes. I believe more than there was in North Point. I'm trying to remember this officer's name. Well, it doesn't matter. The Canadian officers, mind you, were paid on a similar basis that the Japanese officers got paid according to the Geneva Convention. But the NCOs and other troops never had that privilege. And some of the officers, Lieutenant Corrigan was one, used to come over and give some of the boys an odd cigarette, which I got. And, yes, I should say that in North Point, I guess I'm sort of backtracking here, but they put on several, the officers put on parties or concerts, and they could get somebody up there to sing or somebody. I was up, I remember singing once, and I got three cigarettes for that. I had to bring that up. I think it was Gracie Fields' old Wish Me Luck, as he waved me goodbye, and I sang it once, and the officer in charge said, well, how about leading us in that? So I had to go through it again. I should have got double the rations. But getting back to Shamshiko, the atrocities towards a lot of, not only the officers, but men as well. When the Kamloops kid came along, the beatings and so on of this. I'll remember this officer's name. Yeah, that's still thing it's bothering me. He was booted practically to death by that Kamloops, same Kamloops kid. And then we ran into a siege of diphtheria. We had a lot of boys die from it. I remember Jack Crawford, our medical officer, and a British medical officer, arguing with the Japanese that they needed more serum for this to stop the infection. I was very lucky. I wound up as a carrier, and a bunch of us were put in behind a separate part of the camp to keep us away from everybody. And we were also the burial party, if you like, to bring the bodies to the from the morgue into the trucks that would be waiting. Be as many sometimes as five, six, seven, eight a day. And you know, it was hitting pretty hard, some of these fellows.
I really don't know anything about the theory. Is it a painful disease?
No, you just it's a membrane that forms in your throat, and you really, if they can't get this out, you suffocate, I suppose. That's the easiest way of describing it, as much as I know about it. But these two doctors, they operated on some of the boys and cut the membrane in the throat that helped them to, some of them, to survive.
Were you ever getting any medicine?
No, we didn't get very much medicine.
How about the Japanese?
No, not that I know of. I couldn't tell you that. Of course, there's always lots of black market stuff, you know. There was some of the boys had lots of nerve, maybe more nerve than the others, and they always were good wheelers and dealers, and they weren't afraid to approach some of the Jap guards and so on. I had gotten rid of pretty well everything that I had with the guards. Some of the guards, you know, you must remember some of the guards, they weren't all bad. You had, the majority of them were, but there were some good ones, you know.
Was Campbell talking about one of the worst? Everybody thinks
it's hard. I think so. I think he was. Possibly, except for when we were in.
Of course, he was a Canadian, that would make it a little bit worse.
Then, in. We were working at Kai Tak Airport in fall of 42, and when we came home around in November the 23rd or 24th, I know it was very close to my birthday, we come in and the camp from Kai Tak, and the International Red Cross had started to move, or the Japanese had started to move in a lot of tea and sugar and bully beef and stuff from Geneva. And we were given that was our first Red Cross parcel. It was in November the first part of December 1942.
Did you have to share it, or did you
just... On that one? Not on that one. I don't think so. I think we were given that whole...
Did you get any mail?
Oh, no. My mother and dad didn't know I was living until... See, they came in and taped on records, Japanese. They allowed some tapings to be done. I don't remember whether that was in Shamshipo or in Japan. It doesn't matter, but anyway, it was 19... Oh, it must have been... It had to be in Japan. My mother and father didn't know I was alive until January or February, I think, of 1944. It was picked up shortwave by a woman in San Francisco. And they had, these people in San Francisco had written a phone or something. My mother and dad told them that this thing had been picked up. But then, well, the food wasn't too bad when we had the British, the International Red Cross food.
Did anyone from the Red Cross
come out? Oh, yes, but the Japanese were on their very best behavior. The ground, everything was pretty shipshape when they come around.
Were you allowed to talk to them, or did they
try
to talk to
them? Oh, no. I don't know. There may have been some of the boys talked to them, but I know I didn't. And they seemed to... Well, they would talk to the officer, but not to their troops. Then, when we... you're running out? I guess it was somewhere around the spring of 1943, I got a rapid heart. I couldn't walk any more than maybe 150 yards or something, and I'd have to sit down. My heart was getting going about 160, and I was failing a bit that time. Oh, I was probably 115, 120 pounds. And they finally put me in the hospital, in the camp. That was in Champshpo. And also, you've heard of the hot feet, which is a breakdown of the protein sheath around the nerves, which causes very sensitive feet, and a lot of the boys had to they used cold water. Some used cold water to soak their feet in, and others had to use warmer water. Now why, I don't know. I'm not a doctor, so I can't very well express an opinion. I had that, but I don't know, maybe I was luckier than others. I wouldn't put my feet. I remember once putting my feet in water. But you could lay on the bed. I remember laying on the bed in this hospital hut. And, I was put on to thiamine hydrochloride, which is vitamin B1, I believe. And this one night I was laying there, I hadn't got very much sleep for two or three nights, and this British doctor came in, and he must have thought something of me for some reason, I don't know. But he asked me if I'd slept, and I said no. I slept for a couple of three nights. He said, well, he says, we may see you later. So in the meantime, I had fallen asleep, and an orderly came around. That was one of our own men, an Allied soldier, prisoner. He came around and he woke me up, and he said, I got a needle for you. So they gave me a shot of morphine. Jesus, I was still a bit drowsy, and boy, I fell asleep. And it's another little story that I'll never forget, and by God, I don't know how long I slept, maybe a few hours. And I was dreaming that I was sitting on a little bridge over a small brook. It wasn't any wider than six feet wide, maybe. And I had my feet dangling in the water, and these bloody fish with big, long snouts on them that just looked real. I was kicking these things out of the water to beat hell. And I woke up kicking the bed. Oh, geez. I was around 4 o'clock in the morning, I guess, I woke up. So we, of course, all over the camp, you get two cans and you put them together, and you put a wire in each can, and then you separate them with a little insulation. You can make, boil water with it, So we had a cup of tea at about that time, and I felt a lot better. But my heart was still going pretty fast, and they decided that I should go to Bowen Road Hospital. So I was in there. I think I went there in early part of May or something, and I come back in, it was either the end of April or May, the first part of May, until I believe around the 1st of August, and they got my heart back to normal. And then that was August 15th, I believe, was the date that our first Canadians went to Japan. And then on, that was the date we left for Japan, August 15th. And we went on this tramp steamer.
Is this the second group?
Yes, second group. The others left, I believe, in the spring.
What was going on in San Francisco? Were men going out to work?
Oh yeah, they were going. They were going out to work on Kai Tak Airport. But anyway, I wasn't in too bad a shape. I had this foot trouble yet, and with that you lose. You don't have any great amount of control over your feet, like on the cords in the front of your feet lose their power seemingly, because you had what you call drop foot, or like you walk along and your foot just dropped down. You couldn't hold. You didn't walk normally. But anyway, we got on this boat and we left Hong Kong, I believe. The 15th or 16th of August, 1943. And we got as far as Kwiling, Formosa. And we were there for a week, approximately a week. And they allowed us above, up on deck there. But when we left Formosa, Taipei, whatever you like to call it. We got to Japan, and about a day and a half before we got to Japan, we were not allowed above, up on deck, which became rather a ruddy disaster, because on that ship we only had enough room to sit down in, with maybe enough room for our legs, and we were like that all the way. And but on the last day and a half, I remember, where they wouldn't allow us up. We had no toilet facilities. It was fellows with dysentery, and the little bit of food we got wasn't that much, and it was a lot of moisture in it. And of course, the kidneys wasn't too strong. And when we came into, we're coming into Osaka, all we had to dispose of the water for about, I don't know how many men were in that hold, particular hold, but I guess there must have been a couple of hundred or so. We had 1 quart bottle, and the only way we could get rid of it was use it and throw it out the porthole. The one thing that couldn't stop it from opening. And that was, I thought that my bladder was going to bust. It wasn't funny at the time, did it? But anyway, when we got off the boat in Osaka, they treated us pretty good. They had box lunches for us. They had, I would say, if there's such a thing, sort of a home, a non-combatant type soldier. And they were, as far as I remember, they were supposed to have been the emperor's guards or troops or something. And we were treated reasonably well until we got to Niigata.
Did people sort of like come off the boat and have lunch?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you get on a train?
Yes, we were on a train. We went to Niigata, Our first camp that we were in, there was 300 of us went to Niigata. It was 25 Dutch fellows off the submarine that was sunk off of Saigon, and 275 Canadians. In the first 3 months we were there, we lost about, I believe, around 60 to 70 men, one of which was caught for stealing food from the Japanese. He was tied to a stake. This was in the winter of 43-44. It was closer to, I suppose, February or March. He was tied to a stake outside the camp in barefoot, snow on the ground, and he was left there for 1 week. And when he couldn't stand any longer, he was thrown into a shed, and it was this was for our benefit, but don't try and steal food. But that fellow was finally the doctor that was there convinced the Japanese that should be allowed to bring him into our hospital room that we had there. And might say he lasted a few more days, but gangrene had been set in. His feet and legs had been frozen so bad, and hands and arms, that he died a few days after. But the screams from him and the pain that he must have gone through was really something.
Is this a Grenadier?
No. And he was an American fellow.
Were the Americans at the camp?
Oh, yeah. No. No, we opened that camp. This is after the Americans come, I believe. In January, I think. No, it was later. No, there was no Americans in that camp. Not that. That's the first camp we were in. But that was when we were pretty low at that time. That was in 43, early 44. I got dysentery again.
You mentioned a lot of men had died.
Dysentery, no medicine. The people that just couldn't take it any longer. They just said, I've had it. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to die, you know. Yeah. It's one of the easiest things in the world to do if you have no will to live.
You didn't give any more food than you
had? No. But the worst thing there was, I suppose, there was this major general, I believe he was, or some kind of a general of the Japanese army, who came there with an interpreter that was an American citizen from, he had gone to the University of Southern California. He could speak perfect English. And this Japanese officer in charge of prisoner of war camps had come back from the Southern Pacific as a commander of some part of the operations, maybe in the Marshall Islands or something like this. And he got up and he said, there shall be no surrender until your countries are annihilated. Well, at that time, I would say it looked rather bleak as far as we were concerned. And then shortly after that, we were taken from that camp and we were put into another camp, a bigger camp. And we were there for a short while. And see, these huts had this cement white type shingles on, what do you call it? Not a thatched roof, but these, you know, these heavy, about 3/4 of an inch thick shingles, you know? Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And of course, these things were all put together with no nails, you know, they were all just put together wooden pegs. And the bottom, the roof was much heavier than the rest of the building, and just I was in the, our particular group was in the next building, was in the, our particular group was in the next building to this one, and it collapsed, and we lost I think 7 or 8 boys, most of them grenadiers, in that collapse of that house. Shack or hut, as you like to call it. This was a very hard camp. There was a either a lieutenant or Captain Sato. He was psycho. He broke his sword over one of our guys' arms, the flat of the sword, luckily. Otherwise, he would have cut him in two. And he. He used to, well, there was one particular American fellow, he kicked with his jack boots right down the center of the camp. And he had a lot of little goodies like that that he would come up with. I didn't bother even thinking about the camp. I was only interested in trying to get out, hoping that I would live long enough to get out.
Was there one thought in your mind all the time of getting out of yes. food?
Yes. No. Food, of course, was. I would say that probably. Food was a factor, but I guess I would have to say my belief in I was going to get out of there was, and I used the philosophy in my own mind that I was getting out every 3 months. This was my belief at all times. I think that maybe if some of the other boys that knew me would probably say the same thing. But in that, it was in this summer 44, I guess, that, no, it would be later. I guess it was in the fall of 44, when things looked up slight bit better, maybe, for part of our group where we unloaded coal boats and pushing these about 1.5 tons of coal around on a little truck, you know, four-wheel truck on a track and dump it over the side of these trestles, you know. And then we were our group was transferred to Marutsu, which were food handlers, real stevedores. And we got over there and we were able to steal oranges and apples and so on, dried squid and stuff like this that helped us. Yes, and we were, some of the guards gave us parched beans, soya beans, perched on a shovel, you know, it made them like peanuts. And then we used to steal an awful lot of beans, tie the bottom of our pants and walk up to one of these and rip them, rip the bag and let the beans run in. But at that time there was one young Korean fellow in the Japanese engineers that I made a very, he was a very good friend of mine. He could speak some. I guess you finished it.
Yeah, I just
As I was saying, I ran across this young Korean soldier that was in the Japanese army. How I got to know him, I don't know his name. I never did get to know his name. But One day we were unloading some blue herring, and he was going by, and I happened to turn around, and he was motioning to me to throw him some fish. So I watched the guards, and he stopped for a minute, and I pitched a couple of fish over to him, and he never forgot that. Every opportunity he got, he was at the docks looking for me. He brought me, one day he brought me two eggs, first eggs I'd seen for close to 4 years.
Chicken eggs.
Chicken eggs, yeah. And boy, when I got in at noon hour with these two eggs, I was the talk of the bloody camp, believe me. And he brought me rice balls, and he would come to me. He could speak a little bit of English and Japanese, and I could speak a little bit of Japanese and a little bit of English. And we would get together, and he would tell me in our own pidgin Japanese and pidgin English and so on. And of course we had Sergeant Rance, our interpreter, who was in the Hong Kong Volunteer Defense Corps, that came with us to Japan. And he could speak better Japanese than the Japanese could themselves. He was fantastic, this man. So I'd bring in my interpretation of what this fellow had said and so on and so forth. And it was him that, I guess I was the first one to know that the Russians had joined the fight against the Japanese, and through him. And when the U.S. Navy had come up to Kyushu and so on, was shelling Kyushu and so on and so forth, and then
things would be looking brighter at
that time. It was beginning to look a little bit better.
Did the Americans bomb around the camp?
I guess I got ahead of myself a little bit, because the Americans come over. They never bombed us. They never bombed that city of Niigata. They only came over with B-29s to drop magnetic mines into the bays, try and stop shipping from getting in. But this started in 1944, and the odd time there was B-1 or two of these planes come over broad daylight, you know, at about 45,000 feet. Japanese couldn't get up there, and their anti-aircraft couldn't hit. And I remember we were in this, we had eaten dinner, and we had had a few minutes after dinner, and there was, I forget the name of the fellow that was lying under this tree, dozing away, and these two B-29s come over, and they drop pamphlets. Now, I don't know whether you've heard of how they drop these pamphlets. They just don't throw them all out of the plane, but they're loaded in such a way that they, as the air pressure builds up, they might come down 4,000 or 5,000 or 10,000 feet or 20,000 feet, and then all of a sudden this thing just explodes. Okay? And of course then the pamphlets start. But this explosion in the air, this fell out of this tree, he jumped up out of there, and he ran, and he just happened. He didn't know really what happened, you know, coming out of his sleep. And anyway, that was, they dropped pamphlets periodically, and then at night they dropped these.
Did you ever get to look at a pamphlet?
Oh yeah, well they're all in Japanese. You know, they were made for the Japanese population. And then at night, I believe there was only one of those B-29s shot down in all the safaris they had over the city. So anyway, going along, let's see, When we, I guess it goes into, oh yes, I was going to say that at this time when these bombs or magnetic mines were dropped in the bay, I was still on the Rinko docks loading coal, and you know the Japanese used to get quite excited when they see a ship coming in loaded to the gunwales with their coal from Korea, I suppose. And this one day I remember there was they were sort of like a Liberty ship that the Americans had in the Second World War, just a very thin skin, you know, over a frame. And one good, well-placed bomb or mine would level her. And this one was sailing in so beautifully, and all of a sudden, boom, up she went. About 20 minutes, she was down under the water. And it was right after that, I'd say, we went over to the Maruzo docks too. But in this, we unloaded everything there. I broke my toe, and when I went to work on I was at Maruzo, and I let a piece of pig iron fall on my foot, and I broke my big toe, and I was excused from work. I couldn't walk, so I had to excuse. And so anyway, after that, they decided that I was ready to go back to work, and I had been in camp for 2 or 3 weeks or something. And I was around 90 pounds. That's the lowest I went, 90 pounds. And that was about the time that I just about give up the ship again, because I had had dysentery again, and I just lost. But I had a couple of friends that kicked me out of bed and made me get moving. But when I went back to work, these 90 kilo bags, 90 kilos, which is about 215 pounds, they threw one of those on my back. Well, I went down like as though I was poleaxed, you know. And I got up, they lifted the bag up, and the Japanese guards called me just about everything they could think of, and I get that bloody bag of beans back in his bag and make him stand up. So I staggered away with my 215-pound bag of beans, and finally I got in pretty good with this here, you know, Korean fellow, and
he
was in the Japanese engineers, and he kept me posted up right up till he disappeared around the August the 12th of 1945. This was when we were coming into their shack for dinner. There's quite a few battle wagons in the harbor at that time, and not very far from our shack. And we were maybe, I don't know, a quarter of a mile or less from our shack where we had our dinner. And the clouds, it was a broken sky, you know, holes in it, you could see the blue through it and so on. All of a sudden, we looked up and planes came through. They came through in a single file. They were the old P-51s, which were propeller-driven, of course. But they were a pretty snappy little boat, little airplane, fighter plane. And they come through, and we said, "American Skokie," which is American plane. "Oh, no, 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 Japanese. Bullshit to you, buddy. Out of here. Let's get out of here." So we ran for the shack, and we got in the shack right before it. But there was no air raid warning. Nothing. They snuck right up on them. And all hell broke loose. And I remember there was one fellow from Guam that had been taken prisoner on Guam, the Marianas. And he had lost all the hair on his body. He didn't have one stitch of hair. And he was sitting at the same table as I was, and there was this battle wagon just maybe 200 or 300 yards over on the dock from us where our shack was. And as far as we could figure out, there was four planes, four of these dive bombers dived on the bow of the ship, four on the back and four on one side, and they just come roaring in over top of our shack, and it was just like a, you might say, a tar paper shack. And if it was, if they had ever miscalculated, we wouldn't have been here today, because they were firing cannon, you know, out of the, I don't know what size of, but they have a pretty good sized cannon out of those things, and that ship opened fire out with everything they had. And they raised a lot of hell in general. I understand there was two or three of the planes shot down because they were coming pretty close, you know, to the ground. And after it was all over, that was pretty well, they didn't take us, they took us out on the docks, and then they said, get them off those docks, these guys are liable to be back again, I guess. So we went back to barracks to camp that night, and we were held in camp. And then the Japanese figured there was no way that, I guess they could see the handwriting on the wall.
So their attitude, I guess, would change a little bit.
Oh, yes, it did. Oh, yeah. Well, and then, all right. And then anyway, when we, on the 13th, 14th, 15th, they put us to work carrying these logs from about 2 or 3 miles out from the bush. And
was
firewood for the winter of 1945-46. Because that was August, as I say. It was getting on towards...
And did you ever have firewood before, or had you been?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we had firewood, but it was green, you know, lots of smoke. And anyway, we're going out in teams and groups and so on. But on the 15th, I don't remember what time it was now, but this one Japanese fellow that had all his fingers and toes cut off, who had been a prisoner of war under the Chinese. As I say, he came out of that barracks, out of the guard room, and said, war over me, prisoner. And I said to the boys, I said, did you hear that? And they said, what? I said, well, I just forget his name too, but so-and-so said that the war was over and he was a prisoner. And so this never stopped. They went for another load of wood. But after that, it was all over. And then...
Yes, did you find out for the officially the end of the day?
Not really. Nobody officially told us. Other than that, really. And there was no more activity in the camp. The camp commandant, he disappeared. I've been given to understand that the findings was that when they tried to find him after the war, that he had committed hara kiri. There was one thing I failed to mention, summing up our little escapade, was during it was in the winter of 43-44, when we were on the coal docks, there was one American chief petty officer or some such rank as this that was in pretty good with the Japanese, and the Japanese used to feed him pretty good too. Not that some of our own guys weren't in pretty good with the Japanese. This American fellow gave me an order and I refused to obey it. And he told the Japanese honcho or guard, Hashimoto, that I had refused to obey his order. And this bugger took his wooden sword on me, and he beat me up pretty badly. And after the war, I was in the sanatorium at the Central TB Clinic, and Major Hansel from the Ajax, Adjutant General, whatever it is, office, anyway, the Canadian Army, that was during the war trials. And this picture was brought to me and said, "Do you know this fellow?" And that on my say that he got 20 years out of it, hard labor, so maybe I got back at one of them. Then another time I had, we were loading a carload of coal with what we call yoho sticks. These are like a yoke with a basket on each end. And we were loading railway cars. And I don't know what I did. I guess I must have taken a heart seizure of some kind. I don't know. I collapsed. And it was in the winter time. And then they figured I was cold. So they brought me, and I was still, I guess, breathing, all right, that sort of thing, and I had some wits about me. And they tried to put my hands in the fire of this fire pot we had, you know, and I kept pulling the bloody thing back. My hands were cold. My whole body just seemed to seize, you know. Not necessarily maybe my heart, something went wrong. So I got out of working that day. But it didn't last. My legs stiffened and my arms stiffened, and I couldn't do anything. So anyway, as I say, they took a little more pity on me after that. But anyway, after August 15th, we put in a little time waiting to find out. We were told we had to build it. They built a big sign. People in the camp built a sign, PW. We mounted it up on a hill behind it. And then on August the 24th, I think it was the 24th, the American come over, started looking for us. They found us. And they said, "Well, we'll." They didn't have anything. They just wanted to find us. So they found us, and they dropped one of the, I guess it was, whether it was squadron leader or whatever he was. I don't know anything about Air Force. He came, made a pass, and he dropped a note. He says, "We'll be back at 4:00 in the afternoon." They were back. That was just as good an air raid as you'll ever find. They tried to drop everything inside the camp on a small postage stamp size deal when the guy's coming over it, maybe, I don't know, 250 mile an hour or so, 300 mile an hour. And dropping kit bags and what have you, you're bound to miss them, because they had to go over right behind our camp. There was a hill that they had to get over after they dropped this stuff. It's a wonder some of them didn't get dashed up pretty good. And anyway, they dropped everything, you know, they could. And they made a pass, and they said, "Well, I'm sorry, we have nothing more." But that helped an awful lot. I think it was before that that some of the boys went out and bought an old cow. I think when they killed it and dressed it, I think it weighed something around 200 pounds or something like that. It was mostly bones. But it made a pretty good stew. And then, I forget the date that the B-29s come over in single file, dropping food. Well, we get the hell out of camp. because they made a shambles of that place. But
they dropped a lot of food.
Oh yes, they were using 2 45-gallon drums welded together with 2 parachutes on it, and that those parachutes didn't hang on. As soon as after the first drop, we just didn't stay in camp. We got the hell out of camp. Let them drop, and then we came back. But towards the end, or before we left there, they were dropping food in cases from Guam. You see, they were coming in from Guam all the time. That was where the big air base was. And, the only thing I did wrong was we were given, I think it was 20 2-ounce Hershey enriched chocolate. And I sat down, I remember still sitting there on the end of my bloody booth eating this 22 ounce chocolate bar. And even today I don't care whether I eat chocolate or not, except only the odd time, maybe once a year or something. Then we
did you know how the war ended? Did you hear about the atomic bomb?
Oh, yes. Well, only the only thing we heard was that this one night, and I don't remember whether it was the first or second one that was dropped, but we were taken out of camp one night in, I think it was in July, August or sometime, and taken away back into the hills, that the Japanese were expecting the largest air raid in the history of the war. That's all we know about it. I couldn't say, because we were 250 miles or so from anywhere near where those bombs dropped, so we couldn't say. That was about all we could to say about that.
But you heard eventually that they dropped a bomb?
No, not really. Not that size of a bomb. But the Americans, that if the war hadn't have ended when it did, Nagata was next for the atomic bomb. This was common knowledge that Nagata was going to be eliminated. So we were very lucky the war ended when it did. Well, in September 1945, a train came in, and we got down to the train, and we were taken to Tokyo.
Is this by Americans?
Yeah, well, Japanese trains, but the Americans, we never seen the Americans until we got to Tokyo, except for one of the commanders off the aircraft carriers. You know, they came down, and it was one or two of them, I think, came in, I just forget. No, they dropped down on one of the airports around Nagata and said, well, you'll be out of here shortly, so they made it pretty good. The Americans, to me, were all heart with us, because when we got into Tokyo, and as I seen it, those a lot of battle-hardened Americans that had fought up all the way through the South Pacific and Iwo Jima and Okinawa and all right up, they were tough bastards. And boy, if a Jap had said anything, he would have been cut in two. They all carried submachine guns. Every one of them that I remember seeing. And we got on the electric train from Tokyo to Yokohama, and we got over there, taken off the train, and the American says, just don't stop, just go right in there, get rid of all those clothes, have a shower, we'll give you some new clothes on when you get out the other end. So that's what we did, and then they took us on to a destroyer, into the galley, and we ate our fill of bread and butter. Or anything else they could find. We ate all the butter that was in the place. There was no butter left on that ship. At least that's what they told us. So then we were transferred to the USS Ozark in Tokyo Bay. And we were there for a week. And then we were taken to Guam. We were there for, I just forget, 3 days or something like that, 3 or 4 days. And the Americans treated us like kings. Every day on board that ship, and they'd see the old ship bell would, you know, the old whistle would, you know, that, you've heard it, I suppose. Now hear this, all the Canadians line up for a cigarette. Parade, you know, or whatever they were going to give us that day. The Americans all had money because they were given money in Tokyo. But our bunch, we never had anything. But anyway, we didn't do too badly. And the Americans treated us very well in Guam. They gave us a medical examination in Guam. And I had been treated for dysentery in Niigata. And I was also a suspect for TB at that time. And they burned, you know, what I figured earlier, into the camp and had marked us off on squares after you. And then they put a punk on your stomach for dysentery and they burned them. There was 8 spots on my stomach that were quite badly scarred because they. This punk, they burned it to chase out the. But this is a known treatment.
Did it work?
I don't remember it working, only it was pretty painful at the time. You want to try lighting 4 little fires on your stomach, you'll find out. So anyway, when this doctor in Guam seen these burns, oh gee, he just lit out of that office as though he'd shot from a gun. But eventually it was found out. And we were also on. We'll say, I guess, interrogated there, and we were to give a report of our story of the atrocities and so on, and there was numerous, probably more than I will ever be able to remember.
You don't remember the bad times.
Well, I would probably say that I could go back. But, and probably as you think, you know, you're always got your mind wandering a bit back and forth, and there are little incidents that come up that could be brought up, but rather than do that, so anyway, we left Guam, we went to Honolulu, or Pearl Harbor. We were there for couple of days. Then we left for the shores of North America. And when we left Pearl Harbor on that USS Ozark, we had a streamer, you know, the Americans here are great for show, and boy, they put on quite a show. We had a streamer, I would say, must have been 1,500 feet from the mast, with balloons holding it up and anchors away, blaring away. So then we got across the water to San Francisco, and we went under the Golden Gate Bridge and we got into San Francisco, and we were taken off the ship and onto launches, and we went out past Alcatraz somewhere. They didn't stop there. Yeah. And we were taken to a military camp somewhere out by Golden Gate Bridge or something, or out further than that somewhere, for 2 or 3 days. We were met there. That was the first time we had met any Canadian officers. They were from Ottawa, from that same Ajax outfit, I believe, or some such outfit as that. And it was official. It was an official party, welcoming party. We were given $20 there.
By the Canadian?
No, by the American. We were given everything. We didn't need money.
Did the Canadian officials give you anything?
No, not the, no.
We just sort of like a welcome back?
Yeah, just, hi folks, good. It was American officer standing there flipping coins. It looked funny, these Canadian officers, I forget what they were, doesn't really matter. I don't want to sound bitter at this.
No.
But anyway.
It's just that I've heard this from everybody. The Americans are good when you get back from either Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Where you got, if they gave you money, they took it off your pay.
Well, anyway, we just were treated very royally. We were, if we asked for a package of cigarettes, they said, how many cartons? We got food that a king would have. We were given everything, Canadians, by the Americans. And I'm not only by the American government, but the American Red Cross and everything was, we were VIPs. And so anyway, then we left there and we got on a Pullman train in San Francisco, I think it was, or Oakland. And we were given a berth, And we got up to Seattle, and then we boarded a Canadian boat there to Esquimalt.
Did you have to go through customs?
Oh, no. No, no. That was, I didn't even know there was such a thing as a customs. But we got into Esquimalt, and there was well, it gets harder to. I don't know whether the other guys it bothered them, but I remember probably those days better than anything, And I remember coming down that ramp, and there was this, well, old biddies and young biddies and so on and so forth. And this one old gal, I remember, she says, I'm going to kiss every damn one of them. And we, of course, hadn't been used to crowds too much. And anyway, we got into a Esquimalt. And we were taken to Gordon Head Barracks, just outside of Victoria. I should say this is where we got our first pay, with Gordon Head Barracks. And we got our Canadian uniforms. Up to then we were good, damn good Yankees, We had all American clothes. We could put on a new set of American clothes every day. So anyway, we were there for a number of days. We were invited out to several places. One particular place we were invited to, this old lady claimed that she was a personal friend of Winston Churchill, and she proved it. She phoned him. I don't know whether I was talking to Winston Churchill or not, but I was talking to someone, and she put in a call for overseas, so to England, so I don't know whether this is a fact or not. Anyway, we had a lot of fun there. We got tanked up pretty good too. And anyway, then we were there for 2 or 3 days. I don't know how long, maybe a week, I think. But we were also royally treated there. We had white tablecloths on the table, and we were waited on. flowers on the table, etc. So anyway, it took us a month, over a month, to get from from Tokyo to Winnipeg. So anyway, we got on board another boat that took us from Victoria to Vancouver, and practically the same thing happened there, that I had a bet with one of the guys that I was going to be the first one off the boat, this boat, and get on to real North America. And Jesus, I'm telling you, I did get off the boat first. And my pal was right by me, and there was a number of us getting off the boat, and we were pretty near charged by the crowds that were there. I got scared, I'll be honest with you. And we started heading back for the boat. But anyway, we got off, and somebody met me there. I don't know who it was. It was some relative. And anyway, we got on board the train, and we pulled into Winnipeg on October the 9th, 1945. Gordon had buried, see, my brother had been killed in Italy in 1943 or 1944. And I'd heard, my dad wrote me a letter and told me about it. So that was, so when I got home, my mother and dad, we got off at the CPR. And, crowds. That's hard to explain in detail. I don't think I would try. But anyway, we got home, and
I understand there's a lot of just mobs and a lot of confusion.
Well, there was.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I think you've got to take your hat off to people of Winnipeg is that they put up with us. I don't know how bad, I don't think, except for the odd one that got out of hand a little bit, or maybe got a little bit too much to drink or something. I don't think we got into any great amount of trouble because the police were, well, I guess even today we sort of have the upper hand that if Hong Kong, unless he's really bad, things quieten down for him if there's, you know. But I don't think that there's not that many of the boys have gone into that much trouble. There's maybe three or four that taken out the wrong way. But I was home for 1 year. I had a bit of trouble with my health when I come home. I was in Deer Lodge. For a month or so in May of 1946. And then I was a suspect for TB, but they didn't find anything. It was supposedly hidden behind my shoulder bone here. But anyway, on July the 12th of 1946, I was married. On December, just to make a long story short, on December the 4th of 1946, I went to the sanatorium for 11 months approximately. And I was home for a year, and then I took up, my first job was driving a truck, and it was a pickup truck for Consolidated Motors.
Did you find it difficult to adjust?
Somewhat. If there was too many people around, you just broke out in a cold sweat usually. Why, I don't know. I guess it was just because of your nerves. Even to this day, a lot of Hong Kong guys have a nerve problem.
Some of them had mentioned to me that when liberation finally came, it was sort of a fearful feeling in a way. Even though you were prisoners, at least you were there and the future was very uncertain.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to get this thing over with, I'll just finish it off. I've been in accounting, and for the last 20 some odd years, and I have 5 children, 3 of them married, and as far as I know, my health is still reasonably good, and I hope it will continue to be. And I want to thank the Museum of Man and Nature of Manitoba for the opportunity of expressing this little story, for what it's worth.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.